Welcome to Morning Report Top Stories, a selection of news from Radio New Zealand National's Morning News Programme.
The long-awaited rollout of COVID-19 vaccines to the general population starts today. But the government is being told to come clean about when people can really expect to get their first shot. The first portion of the 2 million people that are in Group 4 are now eligible to get their jab. Hamish Cardwell filed this report.
Today marks the start of the government's long-promised ramp-up. It begins with people aged between 60 and 64. But when I spoke to Auckland GP John Cameron, he sounded far from convinced.
Group 4 officially opens, and so I assume the...
Yep.
Tell me about why you're laughing. Tell me.
Yep. Oh, it's not going to happen. We're still working through Group 3 at the moment. If you're looking at Group 4, I think you might be able to book something, but it won't be eligible for you to get for a significant period of time from now.
That's despite huge demand from Group 4 patients for the jab at his clinic. When they ask him when will they be able to get the shot, he tells them he doesn't know, but reckons not for another month at least. Dr. Cameron says that is because there's simply not enough places allowed to give vaccine, his clinic included. He says the government and officials need to start being more upfront with the public about how long they will likely be waiting or risk sowing distrust.
So maybe a little bit of hard truth, a bit of hard noise in there to say, this is where we're at, this is the troubles that we're having. There is nothing worse than over-promising and under-delivering. I think that's where we are at the moment, though.
While central government sets the overall vaccine rollout timeline, it is up to the individual DHBs to deliver it. There's been varying degrees of success in different regions, which is adding to people's confusion. Christchurch Group 3er Bert has been scratching his head. He tried calling the COVID 0800 booking number after seeing an advert on telly.
Well, I rang them up the last couple of days and I got sick of waiting on the end of the phone listening to an answer machine. So I finally got hold of them today, and they said, well, there's nothing available in my area. I'd have to ring my local doctor. I rang my local doctor, and they said, well, they're only doing 85-year-olds plus at the moment. So when you look at the advertising going on over this COVID thing, you wonder what the hell's going on, mate.
That 0800 number was launched last week, and the Book My Vaccine website can be used for online bookings. But GP and Māori public health academic Dr. Sue Kringle says poor and vulnerable people, particularly Māori and the elderly, may struggle to use the services. She rang the 0800 number to book a vaccination for an elderly man and was told she needed to provide an email address and a cell phone number to confirm the appointment. He didn't have either.
And they were like, no, we insist. You know, we have to have one. So in the end, I gave them mine, and that's all good, but... there must be people around who are in similar situations. What happens then? And they don't have family or friends that can do that for them.
She's also worried the shift to Group 4 will divert officials' attention and resources from the vulnerable and the hesitant who still haven't gotten their shots. In the latest available figures, just 12% of Group 3 were fully vaccinated. University of Auckland Professor of Medicine Des Gorman says the government has been promising for months the rollout will really ramp up from now, and it needs to make good.
Contact tracing's nowhere near as good as it needs to be. The borders being a real problem in terms of leaking. So really, the government's credibility in terms of how it manages COVID really hinges upon them being delivering a vaccination program that's extensive enough to the point that they can then move towards reintegrating with the world. So I think their credibility is absolutely on the line here.
The government plans to give out 200,000 doses this week, 50,000 more than last week, and to hit 300,000 a week within a month.
Eli Epiha will not be sentenced until October for the shooting of two police officers and killing one. After deliberating for 10 hours, the jury in the trial yesterday found him guilty of the attempted murder of Constable David Goldfinch. Epiha had already admitted murdering Constable Matthew Hunt. Now, the jury also found getaway driver Natalie Bracken guilty of helping Epiha avoid arrest. Katie Todd's been covering the trial and filed this report.
Call Bracken, two-way priority, we've been shot at.
Unit calling, go ahead.
IPC, two-way, we've been shot at.
Constable Matthew Hunt's final radio call, among hours of evidence heard by a jury over 2 weeks in the High Court in Auckland, along with witnesses, experts, CCTV and phone footage. Eli Epiha fled a routine traffic stop in Massey last June, crashed into a parked car and a bystander, then fired 14 bullets from a semi-automatic rifle. 4 bullets hit and killed Matthew Hunt, and 4 hit and wounded his colleague. But Epiha denied he wanted to kill David Goldfinch. Yesterday, after 10 hours of deliberations, 4 questions and 4 evidential videos replayed, the jury told the judge it couldn't reach a unanimous verdict, or a majority verdict. It was asked to continue deliberating, and shortly after 3:30, the jury returned to the courtroom.
Mr. Epiha, the jury having found you guilty of attempted murder of Constable Goldfinch, you are convicted and remanded for sentence in this court.
The guilty verdict was met with stillness and silence in the courtroom. Afterwards, the Police Association President Chris Cahill described Epiha as cold, calculated and deliberate in his murder of Matthew Hunt, and said the attempted murder of David Goldfinch was clearly laid out during the trial. He says it was nothing short of disgusting watching Epiha try and shift the blame away from himself. Outside court, Matthew Hunt's mother, Diane Hunt, had this to say.
The loss of Matt has been made all the more traumatic by having to hear every possible detail that happened that day. Our thoughts are with Dave and his family, and we would like to acknowledge his incredible courage.
The jury found the accused getaway driver, Natalie Bracken, guilty on a charge of accessory after the fact, of wounding with intent to cause grievous bodily harm. Cell phone footage showed Bracken driving the gunman away in a silver Mazda. Her lawyer had argued that Epiha threatened her. To find Natalie Bracken guilty, Justice Venning said jurors needed to be sure she intended to help Epiha avoid arrest and wasn't acting under compulsion. To find Epiha guilty, he said jurors must be sure that he intended to kill on at least one of the occasions he shot at David Goldfinch. Jurors were told to put aside any prejudice or sympathy.
You may not think much of his explanation for his possession of the Norinco semi-automatic firearm and the other firearm. You may obviously feel sympathy for Constable Hunt and Constable Goldfinch and their families. Feelings of prejudice and sympathy are, of course, natural human reaction. But I must direct you that you are to put those emotions and feelings to one side.
Earlier in the trial, Epiha's lawyer Mark Edgar argued his client only shot towards David Goldfinch to scare him away and didn't know he'd hit the officer. Crown lawyer Brian Dickey said Epiha set out to kill police officers that day, selecting the most efficient of 2 weapons and sauntering away when he saw Constable Matthew Hunt wounded.
And when we really get down to it, there is compelling evidence of his intention to kill Constable Goldfinch. Tragically, Constable Hunt didn't get away, Goldfinch did, but the design was the same.
Epiha and Bracken are due to be sentenced on October 1st.
Well, with us now is the Police Commissioner, Andrew Costa. Morena. Commissioner, can you hear me okay?
I can. Good morning.
Good morning. Your reaction to this, obviously, you described it as relief yesterday.
Absolutely. To see, I suppose, this conclusion reached is a huge relief for the organisation and obviously particularly for those involved. Really acknowledge the courage of Matthew's family to sit through the evidence, which was harrowing, and also Constable Goldfinch, who gave such courageous and professional evidence. It was great to see, and a relief for them too.
And compounded, I guess, a little bit by the way in which the verdict was reached. It was a majority, and it took a little bit of extra time.
It did. It's not unusual for juries to think quite carefully about whether the offence alleged has been committed, and that's a good thing. It's a part of our justice system, but of course, a relief when those verdicts came back.
For police officers around the country, with a trial like this, does it put them under added stress and strain?
Look, without a doubt, I think seeing the details of this played out over a period of a couple of weeks is incredibly difficult for the whole organisation. It was a massive impact when we lost Matt, but then to have it replayed again in that detail is really hard and naturally makes people feel uneasy, unsafe.
It also, of course, raises the issue again about things such as arming of the police, the debate about the safety of police officers. Just give us another sense of where you are at with your thinking as the police commissioner on this issue. You still don't believe police need to be carrying sidearms.
Look, safety of the front line is top of mind for me and for the police executive. And when we think about safety, we look at it in the broadest terms. You know, what are the whole system settings that are going to make our people as safe as possible? It's tempting to want to reach for a single solution that would be the magic wand. I'm pretty clear that general arming is not that magic wand. If we look internationally, there's no jurisdiction you would point to go, you know, they're so much safer than us because they carry firearms. We have a very unique style of policing in New Zealand, which sees us enjoy good relationships with the community, and that adds to our safety overall. So whilst you can point to individual instances where having a firearm might make a difference, actually, in the round, we are safe because of the way we police.
What is the latest statistics, though? We're seeing in the media, certainly a lot of high-profile cases involving firearms, some alarming incidents. There's been quite a spate in the last month or two. Is that actually reflected in all the statistics? Are we seeing an increase in gun violence?
The raw data doesn't tell the story like you would feel it might be from the incidents we're seeing. But I think what's unique about what we're seeing is the level of violence and the escalation and willingness of certain groups to use firearms, generally on each other in the gang context, and occasionally turning those towards police. So that is a concern, and we're certainly very focused on getting the firearms out of the hands of those people and focusing on those groups that are doing it.
So it is gangs that are the major problem?
They are the majority part of it, but then we've had some very significant incidents in the last couple of weeks that weren't gang-related. The incident in Auckland where there were multiple carjackings that was not gang-related. So it's not only gangs, it ties back to mental health problems, drug problems, and then mixing the access to firearms and all of that.
Have the gun legislation changes not made any significant difference yet?
They have made a very big difference in our ability to get the right controls in place, but the reality is we have had a lax gun environment for a long time, and it's going to take some time to tighten up, remove firearms that are in the illegitimate sort of fleet. And so the tools are there now for us to do that. You can no longer go and buy the kind of firearm that was used to kill Matthew Hunt, but it will take some time for us to see the benefits of that.
So you talk about the gang violence, and obviously opposition parties in New Zealand are keen to see and have been pushing this issue hard. They want to see more action on gangs. I know you have programs in place, but does the police simply need to be putting more focus, more effort, more teams, more money into the gang issue?
We are more focused on gangs than we have ever been, and that's reflected in the number of asset seizures, prosecutions, firearm seizures that you're seeing. So it's not for lack of focus. We have had a very unfortunate escalation in the environment, which has been caused by new groups being established, many of those seeded by 501s who have brought a new level of sophistication, violence and international networks, and that has disrupted what was otherwise a reasonably settled landscape.
Okay, you say so it's not through lack of trying. Do you have the legal tools? Would you like greater capacity in that sense to be able to go after gangs? Is there some gap in the law that would give you greater ability?
These things are ultimately a political balance that has to be struck. You could get very arbitrary on gangs and do some things that would be clearly at odds with the Bill of Rights. If Parliament wanted to do that, it could do that. The very hard question here is, when does a gang become a criminal group? And what are we prepared to tolerate in a free society to impact gangs? And those are ultimately questions for Parliament about how far they wish to go.
Police Commissioner Andrew Costa, thank you very much for your time.
And the National Party has raised the possibility New Zealand could have avoided the Suheira Aden situation if it had adopted Australia's law that strips terror suspects of citizenship. Aden, who has links with ISIS, was born in New Zealand but moved to Australia when she was six and flew to Syria on an Australian passport in 2014. The case became New Zealand's responsibility after Australia stripped Aidan of her citizenship. With us now is National Party leader Judith Collins. Kia ora.
Good morning, Susie.
On this situation, would you like to see New Zealand seriously consider adopting a law similar to the one in Australia?
Well, I think it is certainly worthy of consideration whether or not we would ultimately go there. It's something that we've looked at before and chosen not to. It's very difficult when you've got someone actually born here as opposed to someone who has received citizenship from New Zealand. So I think that there are two different situations there. Certainly the Aidan situation is extremely unfortunate for New Zealand that we've been left to pick up the pieces after Australia basically poked us in the eye.
But we don't discriminate on whether there are two different tiers of New Zealand citizenship. Is that part of what you think we should be considering? Whether you're born here, that makes you, what, more of a Kiwi?
I think it is something we should actually have a conversation with New Zealanders about what we're prepared to accept when we give people citizenship as a country. I just put aside those who are born here, it's very hard to deal with that one. But when you're talking about being actually loyal to our country, signing up to being loyal to our country, and you end up having someone who joins a death cult that is absolutely dedicated to the destruction of your country, I think that is something that a lot of New Zealanders would want to at least consider and at least know that their senior politicians are thinking about that.
Mm. What about children, though, who perhaps move here when they're very young and become citizens at a young age, before the age of 18? How would that necessarily work? Because you're not in a position as a child to pledge allegiance really to any country, are you?
Well, that's why it's worthy of consideration. And I think it's one of those conversations that New Zealanders want to be able to debate these issues, and they do want the government to think about them. Whether or not that would ultimately be the end result, I think it is worthy of New Zealanders being part of that debate.
If we explore this a bit further, and using the case of Suheira Aidan, practically, when would you anticipate a law like this being activated? Would it be at the point of departure, for example, to join a terrorist group?
Well, I think you're getting a little ahead of this one. It has simply been raised as a possibility by Gerry Brown, our Foreign Affairs spokesperson. It is certainly one that I think is worthy of us thinking about, and whether or not how that would work, and also just who it would work for. But I do
believe... But again, this is important, though, because, of course, she's gone overseas. She is a New Zealand citizen. She's had two children. And my understanding is that the children, even if they're born outside the country, children of New Zealanders are, by right of descent, New Zealanders themselves. So if she was stripped of her citizenship earlier, before she had the children, then they wouldn't be. So this is why it's materially interesting.
Well, that's why it's worthy of deep and thoughtful consideration rather than making it up on the hoof, which I'm not prepared to do. I think it is very important that we consider all those ramifications.
But what is your sense on this? I mean, this is something the National Party raised yesterday. So where are you landing on that at the moment?
Well, I think we feel very sorry for these children. I think that's I can't imagine much worse for these children, that they've been born and brought up in a death cult where who knows what they have seen or been forced to take part in. They have a mother who chose to leave Australia to go and be part of this death cult, to be a jihadi bride. She's done that now three times, and she's, about 25, 26, something like that, and she's been married three times to lots of Islamic jihadists. Now, that is hardly a great upbringing or start in life for children. New Zealand has to now pick up the pieces because Australia basically poked us in the eye and left us to deal with this. She was not radicalised in New Zealand any more than the mosque shooter was radicalised in New Zealand, and we are now going to have to pick up the pieces. It is really deeply unfortunate, but New Zealand will do our best for those kids.
But if we are in a position of now thinking that perhaps Australia's law is not a bad one to consider, doesn't that mean that New Zealand would then be effectively abdicating its responsibility in this situation and leaving people to be the responsibility of yet another country?
Well, they need to take some personal responsibility, don't they? I mean, this is a person who chose to leave Australia, leave the country that had brought her
but
up
if we,
and educated
but, yeah,
her,
but
and
if,
she's chosen to do that.
If we follow New Zealand, if we follow Australia's lead on this, that effectively makes our decision as bad as theirs, isn't it?
I'm not saying that their decision is clearly one that they've made for the benefit of Australia. New Zealand also has to think about our position as a country and for New Zealanders and what the ramifications are. It is absolutely worthy of debate. Whether or not we would end up in that position is another matter, which is why I'm saying, Susie, don't get ahead of the debate. It is important to have the debate and not shut down debate just because it's uncomfortable.
Quick note about the wallabies coming over. Has the government made the right call on that?
Well, they can't really say otherwise when they let the wiggles in, can they? I mean, they've got the wallabies actually live within a pretty much a bubble anyway. And the big issue here is if we had vaccination rates where they should be, rather than only about 10% of the population, if Australia had its vaccination rates where it should be, we wouldn't even be probably having this discussion.
Appreciate your time. Judith Collins, leader of the National Party. Staff at Te Arawhiti, the Office for Māori Crown Relations, are leaving the agency at high rates, with multiple former Māori staff accusing it of racism. Last year, almost one in three people who joined the organisation within a year, that's the highest staff turnover rate of any government ministry or core agency. RNZ understands one long-serving Māori staff member who left relatively recently blasted the agency for racism as he exited. Our in-depth reporter Tianiwa Hurikanganui has been looking at this. Kia ora e hoa, tell us more about Te Arawhiti and what it does.
Well, Te Arawhiti has about 170 staff. A quarter of those are Māori, and its primary role is to essentially ensure the public sector has strong relationships and partnerships with tangata whenua, with Māori. Now, one of its biggest business units is Te Kahui Whakatau. This is a team that negotiates treaty settlements with iwi and hapū on behalf of the Crown. Now, several former Māori employees in this unit have told me they felt they were expected to prioritise concluding treaty settlements quickly over ensuring iwi and hapū were properly dealt with. One woman said, and I quote, "Negotiation is not quite the right term for what we're doing because there's hardly any negotiation about it. The Crown has a predetermined outcome." She said that's really at odds with who she is as a Māori woman.
Now, the recent departure of one staff member seemed to create quite a stir.
Yes, we understand this person's primary reason for leaving Te Arawhiti was because of racism, and that he stood in front of colleagues at his farewell and actually spoke about the racism he encountered before he exited. This was a long-serving member of staff. He'd been working for Te Arawhiti since it was established in 2018 by the then Labour New Zealand First Coalition government. We approached him for comment, but he declined.
Other staff member, another former staff member rather, what have they been saying?
Well, I've since spoken to multiple former Māori employees who believe they also encountered racism at Te Arawhiti and are not surprised about the high staff turnover. One woman described the agency as a revolving door where Māori are the fastest, are often the fastest to leave. She said while the large majority of staff are Pākehā, Māori are often wheeled out to be the face of the organisation at public events. She also felt her decisions or views were often not trusted or respected by Pākehā managers, as she needed to ask permission to do a lot of things that were in the remit of her job description. Other staff told me they felt casual racism or microaggressions were common also.
Well, tell me more about this high turnover of new staff compared with other government departments.
Okay, so to give you an idea, the median unplanned turnover rate for new staff among all other government ministries or agencies was 13.2%, so it was significantly lower than the 30% at Te Arawhiti. Unplanned just means staff who resigned or retired. It doesn't include staff who left because they were on fixed-term contracts. The unplanned turnover rate for all staff at Te Arawhiti last year was 17.9%. The median rate for all other government ministries or core agencies was 12.2%.
And what has Te Arawhiti had to say about this?
Well, Te Arawhiti said in a statement they're not surprised by the 30% new staff turnover because Māori staff are in high demand elsewhere. Te Arawhiti says it's aware of allegations of racism by only one former staff member and they didn't want to comment further on that. When it came to treaty settlement negotiations, they say the Crown needs to act in a respectful way and in accordance to tikanga, but also needs to support groups ready to settle. It says it invests in cultural advisors to ensure all their staff are kept culturally safe. And it also says it's committed to understanding racial inequity, institutional racism and bias, and has processes in place to ensure individual matters are addressed appropriately.
Ngā mihi, thank you very much. In-depth reporter Te Aniwa Huri Hanganui. Our southernmost Mata Corona vaccine clinic gets underway today on Rakiura, Stewart Island. Large numbers of the community came forward to be tested following a COVID scare last month. It's hoped there'll be similar support for the vaccination drive. RNZ's Timothy Brown has more.
Normally, if a community meeting on COVID vaccination garnered 20 people, there'd be alarm bells. But you'd be hard-pressed to get 5% of the entire community to turn up for just a chat anywhere else in the country. At the meeting, there seemed to be a mixed bag when it came to views on the vaccine. But Iris Tate says she's happy to do her bit.
For you, is this about protecting yourself or is it about
It's mainly the community, yes. Particularly hospitality when we have so many visitors, New Zealand visitors at present, but the borders will open in time, we'll have internationals and it's protecting them as well and them protecting us.
She says she'll be lining up to get her shots when the clinic opens at midday, and she hopes others will be eager to join her.
Hopefully in another 3 or 4 weeks I will be fully immunised, and I know there's 5% you may contract the virus, but hopefully me personally and my friends and the community, none of us will end up in hospital.
Rakiura is home to little more than 400 people, and it's estimated about 385 are over the age of 16 and eligible for the vaccine. 4 vaccinators are on the island, and in preparation for the clinic, they tested final logistics yesterday, with 20 locals putting up their hand and pulling up their sleeve for an early jab. First up was Constable Stuart Newton.
We've got an ageing population here, and they're perhaps a bit more vulnerable than others, and I think as part of the community responsibility and looking out for one another, it is our social responsibility to take up the opportunity of the vaccine.
For him it was a no-brainer. Mandy Reti, who heads Murihiku Marae's Māori Wardens, says a lot of dangerous misinformation surrounds COVID-19 and the vaccine. She's fully vaccinated and proud of that fact.
It is everyone's choice as to whether they want to come and have this vaccine. We look around on the news, you hear on the radio, the statistics from different countries throughout the world, and 4 million people who have died, well, that is just about the whole population of New Zealand. You know, that's horrific.
Her whānau comes from Rakiura, and she has a simple message for them and others.
At the end of the day, we have a responsibility to ourselves, and to our whānau and to our hapuaniwi. So again, it is everyone's individual choice, but I would strongly urge my whānau, katoa in the motu, to really look at this.
The clinic runs for 2 days and is open to everyone over the age of 16 on Rakiura. The vaccinators will be back next month to offer second doses.
Let's go to the US. 4 police officers who faced attacks and racial slurs as they defended the US Capitol building in the January riot there have given graphic testimony before the House of Representatives. It was the first hearing before the Congressional Committee set up to investigate the attack by a mob of supporters trying to overturn the election loss of the then President Donald Trump. A black officer, Harry Dunn, described how he was confronted with racial abuse by the mob.
More and more insurrectionists were pouring into the area by the Speaker's lobby near the rotunda. And some wearing MAGA hats and shirts that said Trump 2020. I told them to just leave the Capitol, and in response they yelled, "No, man, this is our house. President Trump invited us here. We're here to stop the steal. Joe Biden is not the president. Nobody voted for Joe Biden. I'm a law enforcement officer, and I do my best to keep politics out of my job. But in this circumstance, I responded, well, I voted for Joe Biden. Does my vote not count? Am I nobody?" That prompted a torrent of racial epithets.
On the line in Washington is our correspondent Giles Gibson. Good morning, Giles.
Hi there.
This has been a very politicised event, this committee hearing, but this testimony was very compelling, wasn't it? And it may, what, quell some of the critics on the Republican Party?
Well, we certainly just saw these police officers, these four police officers, giving a blow-by-blow account, really, of the conditions and the conditions on the ground over the course of several hours on the 6th of January when this mob of pro-Trump supporters stormed into the Capitol. We had Aquilino Gonel, who's a sergeant in the Capitol Police. That's the police department that's in charge of protecting the Capitol complex itself, describing it as a medieval battle, saying that they were fighting hand-to-hand, inch-by-inch. We also had some body camera footage that had never before been seen in public. This police officer, from the view of his body camera, being dragged away from his colleagues, so this sort of wall of shields that they had, riot shields, being dragged into a screaming mob. Of course, going into this hearing, we knew that five people had died as a result of the violence about 7 months ago. We also knew that two police officers who were on duty that day committed suicide in the weeks after the events of that day. But this is really the first time that we've heard in such extraordinary, just excruciating detail, what it was like to be a police officer battling this crowd, this mob, as they tried and successfully broke into the US Capitol building.
A lot of unseen footage played and I guess replayed, just showing how confronting it was from body cams and that sort of thing.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, just watching this body camera video from one of the officers, he is sort of standing. We can see a riot shield. He's pushing it against this mob of pro-Trump supporters who are trying to get past him and his colleagues. And then he is, you watch from the point of view of his body camera as he is pulled into this angry, violent crowd. And at one point you can make out the fact that he is shouting to them, "I have kids." So he is, at that point, it seems like he is pleading for his life as this crowd just surrounds him and drags him away from his colleagues.
Is it going to change or reshape the debate? And we know the Republicans blocked an independent investigation into this attack. Only two Republicans, they are the sort of, I guess, the broken ranks that are on this committee. I note that Fox was running it live this morning when I got up this morning, so it will be a blanket coverage, but is it going to shift that debate?
Well, even before we got to the opening hearing of this committee, we had this pitch battle on Capitol Hill about who was actually going to be sitting on the committee. Nancy Pelosi, who's the Democratic Speaker of the House, had rejected the nomination of two Republican congressmen, saying that they made statements and took actions that just made it ridiculous to put them on such a committee. In response to that, the House Minority Leader, Kevin McCarthy, who's a Republican, then pulled all five of his nominations for this committee. In response to that, Nancy Pelosi then nominated Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger, who are both Republican representatives, but we have to note that they also both voted to impeach Donald Trump when he was still president in the days after this attack on Congress on the 6th of January. And we actually saw the House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy giving a press conference just before the proceedings kicked off. He described it as a failed committee, despite the fact that it hadn't even held a hearing yet. And he also described it as a sham and asked later on after the proceedings wrapped up whether he had been watching it. He said that he hadn't even been watching those proceedings and that extraordinary testimony that we've just been talking about.
Giles Gibson, thank you very much for your time from Washington.
You've been listening to Morning Report Top Stories from RadioNZ.co.nz.